Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
This is almost an example I mentioned earlier where it's, you know, they kind of took over a mountain no one else really knew they wanted. And you built a really nice cash generative business on top of that. And then as long as management makes good capital allocation choices with the cash they generate, you can start getting some pretty decent returns.
I'm Chris Hill, and that's Jim Gillies from Motley Fool Canada. Ricky Mulvey caught up with Jim and his colleague Ian Butler to talk about companies with unusual moats. Some competitive advantages are well known, but let's face it, some economic moats just aren't that obvious, like utility poles, engineering software, even gentlemen's clubs. In this episode, Jim and Ian talk about what makes something a moat and the metrics that can reveal a true competitive advantage.
There's a lot of ways that a company can create a moat, but I think that's really what it comes down to. It's just your ability to sustain a competitive advantage over a long period of time. Is there any other fancy definition or way of describing it in your mind?
One that I like to refer to, I'm not sure it's ever been really, you know, in the textbooks doesn't get equated to moats. Companies that go after industries that nobody else wants. I think we've got a few examples of that planned for you today, but you took control of a mountain no one else knew they wanted, and then kind of at the end of the day you kind of realize, oh, this company controls this subspace. And it doesn't have to be something terribly, you know, exciting and sexy, like, you know, internet security, or sometimes you can find it in some pretty weird little niche places that no one else realizes was a great opportunity, except one or two companies basically go in and seal it up for themselves.
We're going to get weird in a little bit. And I remember, Jim, in some previous conversations about franchise businesses, your personal fave, you've said that, like, you're okay paying a higher multiple on a franchise business for because you know that it's a reliable check cashing machine. Mm-hmm. How does a moat fit in your investing framework? And do you ever find yourself saying, you know what, it might be worth paying for this overvalued company on other metrics because it has such a wide moat?
Well, one of the best things you can find, of course, if you can find one of those, you know, widening or nascent or super wide moats, if you can find that for the bargain price, that's the holy grail. But yeah, I'm fine. One of the symptoms of a moat company for me is they can generally have pretty good carte blanche in raising their prices, controlling their prices. We talked briefly before the show. One example that I have is a private company I know, but they can charge pretty much whatever they want because their customers, when they talk to their customers, there's something like 0.001% of the typical company operating budget. So no one's going to care, right? They're just going to, like, oh, if the supplier company decides to double or triple their price, the customers don't really notice. And so what ends up happening is moated companies, if I can use that as a word, moated companies tend to have pretty good pricing power. They tend to be very good cash generators. And then you hope they're good capital allocators of the cash they generate.
And I think to build a valuation case, I'm just trying to think through some examples that I've experienced over the past. I think you really have to get into the small cap world to find a valuation case when it comes to a moat, as opposed to these mega cap companies certainly have moats, but valuation outside of like crisis times in the market is rarely ever a reason to buy those companies. Autodesk is one that comes to mind. It's a recommendation that we've made in Stock Advisor Canada. It's in several services across Fooldom. I wouldn't say there's a valuation case for Autodesk, but I would say that there's an incredibly strong moat associated with Autodesk, which I think in that case can sort of overcome any valuation concerns that one might have.
Yeah, just for some context, that's the one that a lot of like engineers use where if you're building out a building and you want to make sure that your electrical engineers and your plumbing folks are operating on the same system. What Jim Gillies, what?
This is my engineering ring. As my as the former engineer on the panel, let me tell you that the AutoCAD moat is very, very real. It is basically all you learn to do. And if you want to have portability from one job to another in the engineering space, it's all Autodesk. It's all AutoCAD.
It's difficult for the listeners to see.
Sorry, I just
saw you sticking a finger up at me, and luckily it was your pinky,
not that finger tool,
and not the other one.
American types don't wear engineering rings,
but we don't.
In Canada, the engineers, it's a supposedly solemn ceremony where we all, you know, and there's a Rudyard Kipling poem, and it's a big. It's less serious than they make it out to be when you realize when you go in, but it's still fairly. It's supposed to be a commitment that engineers will not pass shoddy work, will do the best for the public, blah blah blah. So,
I want to talk about some obvious moats because there's some intro folks out there, and I think it's a good way of illustrating that how a company becomes essentially a mega cap or a larger cap company by just building either a balance sheet up or just a vertically integrated system. Like when I think of an obvious moat of a company, you know, I think I would actually go to Live Nation. They own Ticketmaster, they own the venues, they manage the ticket sales, they manage the artists. So if Jim Gillies, you want to see Death Cab for Cutie, it's a very important band. It's not like it's easily substitutable for another jam band like Goose or the Dead & Company. You want to see Death Cab for Cutie, you're going through Live Nation.
I am going, and I have recently twice, yes.
And then to your earlier point, Ian, though, it's something you're going to pay for. I think right now the stock's trading at about 100 times earnings or something like that. So when you think of obvious moats, I know you got one on here, Ian, so I'll start with you. What is an obvious, just an obvious fastball straight down the middle moat that you can think of?
So the company that pops right into mind is only a company that I've come to know over the past year or so. So I suspect that if indeed we have some relatively new investors listening, they will not have heard of it. It's a big company. I don't have the market cap up handy right now. A Dutch company by the name of ASML. And ASML essentially is the ground floor in the entire global semiconductor industry. They make the machines that go into the manufacturers of semiconductors and thereby manufacture semiconductors. So Intel is a client, Taiwan Semiconductor is a client. All these massive semiconductor companies are reliant on the machines that ASML makes. And they have such a lead in technology. That lead is expanding as each new generation of machine comes out. These are hugely expensive machines. I think they're nine-figure machines for one. They sell like 30 machines in a year or something like that. And there's just it's really, really hard to imagine anyone. I don't even think anybody's even trying to compete with them. They're that far ahead, and the capital is that intensive that it just doesn't make sense to compete with them. So that's been a company that I've learned about again in the past couple of years that it has just blown me away at its competitive strength and the depth of the moat there.
All right, let's move to some less obvious ones. I want to talk about pool equipment. You guys countered with rail ties and compressed wood. This is a company that makes utility poles, which is a product that is quite literally grown on trees. We're talking about Stella Jones. Why is Stella Jones a company with a hidden moat?
Well, it starts, if you want me to take the first kick at it, it's a company that both Ian and I have recommended on our respective services in Canada. So if nothing else, we apparently like railway ties and utility poles, which of course are there.
And tucking our own.
Yeah, butt. Exactly. I mean, but seriously, you know, you get railway ties and utility poles. How excited are you, right? Or what do you call? I think Ian calls them the national tree of Manitoba or something like that. The utility pole. Yeah,
somebody once called driving through Nevada on a mining trip once. That's what they. That's what was pointed out. The telephone pole was the national tree of Nevada or the state tree of Nevada.
But it's a moat for similar reasons to what I discussed earlier, where the dollar value of what they're putting in for railroads are massive capital intensive businesses. That's part of why Buffett, you know, went and bought a railway for Berkshire Hathaway, because, you know, it's, you know, we want to be able to reinvest tremendous amounts of capital at ideally high rates of return. But you know, to maintain these networks, these massive networks, is a lot of money per year. And the compressed wood, the creosote soaked railway ties are, you know, they've been what, pretty much the same since the 1800s. You know, this is not, I mean, I know there's concrete railway ties as well, but, you know, these are fairly, fairly simple, fairly localized. There's only a few companies that do this kind of stuff. And Stella Jones happens to be, I believe, the largest one, certainly in North America. And they are able to essentially pass along their cost plus, you know, in inflationary environments. No one's going to bat an eyelash. The big railway company is not going to bat an eyelash at what Stella Jones is requiring to have them. So you have them pay. So you essentially have, it's like the water chemistry example. You know, Stella Jones can put their push through their price increases, maybe a little bit more for their pain and suffering, and the railway companies are just gonna, yeah, okay, cool, that's fine. They're also not similarly going to, this is not a product that they're gonna switch out for, you know, a young upstart competitor in the creosote soaked wood comes along and says, hey, we'll beat Stella Jones's prices by 5%. Yeah, this is not gonna. It's not gonna go, because you're not gonna switch back and forth. They're just gonna go, no, Stella Jones is still kind of, you know, and then on the utility side of things, quite often municipalities have multi-year contracts with Stella Jones to keep them supplied with, you know, with the state tree of Nevada. So I've always loved that line. So it's a case of, this is a company that, you know, they've got products. This is an example, almost a little bit of, we're going to get to better examples, but this is almost an example I mentioned earlier, where it's, you know, they kind of took over a mountain no one else really knew they wanted, and you built a really nice cash generative business on top of that. And then as long as management makes good capital allocation choices with the cash they generate, you can start getting some pretty decent returns.
Do they have any, like, I've always seen utility poles as a commodity, and to be honest, I haven't really seen utility poles and thought much of them. Is this something that, like, are there any real competitors in the space, or is this a market share leader that has just completely claimed the mountain you just described?
I think any competitors that are out there are minuscule in relation. They are sort of the big dog in the pound.
Yeah, we've got a member of a couple of Fool Services who we know, because we've interacted a couple of times on Twitter, and he does work for a competitor of one of, like, basically, you know, they go out and harvest the trees. He's in the tree harvesting business, but for a competitor of Stella Jones, and he has only said in our brief conversations, he's only had positive things to say about Stella Jones, and remarked on they're a hard company to compete against.
This is also a company, though, where growth is fairly predictable. They can project their revenue pretty well, I would assume. But it's also a case where the company's valuation has gotten ahead of itself before. So for the old retail folks, what are the metrics to really watch with this company to make sure they're not paying too much for their utility poles?
I think that's what's historically, I mean, so it was one of the best performing stocks in the Canadian market up until sort of a few years ago when it's kind of flatlined a bit. And that's right. The multiple has historically been very high. It's not high now, and it hasn't been high for a couple of years. So I think at worst, if you just can get this company for its growth prospects alone, for sort of consistent, as you say, predictable revenue stream, growing with inflation and whatever else, any contractual increases it can make, great. But I think there's a case right now, especially where there's potential multiple expansion involved. Like historically, it's sort of been a 20, 25 times earnings type company, and here we are sort of half that. So I think there's a good total return equation in play right now. I think, and it's one too, where you could probably let it go when it does get more fairly valued. It doesn't necessarily have to be a buy and hold forever type of situation, despite its competitive positioning.
Yeah. To build on that, the valuation, I think, is really something you want to watch for this Modi company. And I think people should be aware of that, they were doing very, very well on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And they kept on touting that, even though it kind of stopped after about 2015. The stock got very, everybody thought it was, so the company itself will put out a press release or a slide deck showing how, they'd beaten the market, they beat the S&P 500, they beat the Capped Industrial Index and the S&P TSX. And then you kind of look at how they did it, and it's like, well, but that's a 10-year chart. This or it's actually a 9-year chart where I was looking at it about a year ago. And if you kind of lopped off the first 2 years, all of a sudden, Stella Jones went from a market smasher to, I think, from about March of 2015 through to the end of 2021, I think its annualized return was about 0.7%, because to Ian's point, they had gotten out ahead of their skis valuation-wise. They'd really kind of, they'd become this darling. And so people kind of forgot about them, and the stock meandered down. And so when we were looking at them and recommended them, I don't remember what, Ian, you put them into Stock Advisor at. But by the time we came along to them, and I think we went first in Gems, if I'm not mistaken, but you know, Ian has talked about, 25 times earnings was kind of where these were hovering. By the time we came along to them, I think we were about 11 times earnings. So we got at a much better price. And then, as Ian says, we're looking for multiple expansions. So not only are they growing earnings and growing revenues and growing cash flows and paying you a higher dividend and buying back stock, but maybe if they ever go back to that 25 times multiple, we're going to get, 100-150% return on our cost basis just from the multiple expansion. Forget about the business growth. And in, that it maybe doesn't sound great if you go back and look at the 2020, early 2021, kind of growth stock frenzy. But historically, that's the aberration, and the market we know grows 10, 11% annualized with dividends reinvested. This suddenly becomes a very good argument for buying Stella Jones at roughly the present valuation level.
Next company could not be more different. This is a company that operates a chain of strip clubs, nightclubs, sports bars, and restaurants. It's also a media and convention company that serves the adult club industry. It's RCI Hospitality, formerly known as Rick's Cabaret. Jim, when you presented this, first of all, I had to make sure it was okay for us to talk about on the show. But second of all, when you presented this, I understand how this business is profitable, but what I don't understand with RCI Hospitality is how it has a moat when it has quite a few competitors.
I'm going to suggest to you, not only does it have a moat, it's got multiple moats. And I do thank you for kind of running it through the proper channels, because it's a legal business, but I obviously understand that there could be disparate opinions about this type of business. And so, of course, just no one has to own anything they're not personally morally comfortable with, of course. But in my particular town, where I live in Southern Ontario, there is one approved location for this type of business. Okay. It's actually housed. It's not owned by RCI, but I'm going to get to why it applies to RCI here. It is owned by an individual. It's in a historically significant house for this town where I live. Okay. It's actually in a heritage building. And for the last two decades, they've said to the city, we want to move out to more to the, the industrial ends of town kind of thing. And we would sell you the business and, or sell you the building. And the city says, we have grandfathered in, there will be no more of these types of businesses approved in this town. So nothing has happened and the place is still where it has been for decades. That's a kind of moat, okay? Literally, if they close or move, that service will be gone from the city. And that's kind of what's going on for RCI. They quite often only, they own the only approved, allowed, grandfathered in locale for gentlemen's entertainment club kind of thing. Strip club sounds so sordid. And so they literally have a localized government granted and enforced moat. They don't have to go out and advertise and try to, beat back the competition coming in and setting up across the street from them or across the, like, they're kind of legislated in. And so what ends up happening, a lot of these things have also been sole proprietorships, and RCI is going in and buying up the sole proprietorships or, individual businesses. They're buying them up at relatively low valuations because it's another example of it's a mountain no one else realized they wanted. They're buying it 3, 4, and 5 times EBITDA when they take over someone looking to sell one of these locales. They go in, they pay a relatively low valuation, and they're grandfathered in. So again, whether you agree with the business model or not, and I certainly can see the arguments on both sides, to be honest with you, there is some value in a government, a localized government granted moat. And, one of the arguments, one of the best performing stocks in North America in the past 75 years is Altria, aka Philip Morris, aka the Marlboro cigarette people. Okay. And one of the reasons why it's been so successful has been the tremendous external pressure against owning companies like that. So it's kept it at a low valuation. That company as well, they don't have to advertise cigarettes anymore. They don't have a lot of R&D budget. They make a ton of cash. They pay a ton of taxes. They make a ton of cash, and they roll that cash continually into raising their dividend and buying back shares. And they do so at a really low valuation because of the external pressure. And that's sort of what's unsaid here is since we started looking at RCI Hospitality about 2.5 years ago, I think the stock's a 7-bagger. Okay. Because that's that same kind of principle coming forward here I said to Ian in the past, this is probably, even though given the controversial nature of the business, it's probably not one we want to recommend. But, I think it's worth looking at for people who don't mind the morality of the business. I think it's worth looking at because I kind of hold RCI Hospitality as it's probably got one of the best and most comprehensive, well thought out plans for delivering their free cash flow, what they're going to do with their cash, and their whole capital allocation, stack. So, at this price, we're going to seek, tuck-in acquisitions. At this price, we're going to seek dividends and dividend hikes, maybe a special dividend. At this price, we want to be looking to buy back shares. And I think they've done really, really well. The CEO is known as he was a big fan of the book, The Outsiders, which is all about, capital allocation and, rock star companies that have done well with it. And he kind of, he read that about 5 or 6 years ago. And I think he kind of embraced it as how he wants to run RCI Hospitality. And so, again, you're kind of focused with there's a lot of real good positives that we would like with a lot of stocks in the Foolish Universe. But there is that kind of business that maybe no one else wants. And so you kind of go, that's an interesting combination to me.
It's a company you want to ask questions about. And Glassdoor ratings are always something that can be juiced and you want to look with a more critical eye, especially for smaller cap companies. 94% of employees would recommend working there to a friend. So if this is your space, it sounds like it has an incredibly high employee score, I would say. Let's move on to some final questions. I think the thing about moats, and we were talking about this earlier with some companies, is they can end up being stocks that you own but don't really pay attention to. And that's exactly the case with a company like Pool Corp, which is not selling pool supplies to consumers, but rather businesses. And it's not a stock I own, but it's 20 times larger than its second competitor. And that would give it, I would say, a pretty strong moat in a space, that in a hill that not too many people else are at or on.
Yeah, and it's definitely, I think I said before, I actually own it. And yeah, I couldn't tell you the last time I went and looked at their filings. Just because it's not one that I worry too much about. I would encourage people who are interested in Pool Corp, go have a look at their historical returns, how they've done in terms of, you know, returns on capital, and then what they've delivered to shareholders. It's been to long-term shareholders. Again, this is not something that you should be jumping in and out of, I think. Ian?
And you just raised a question that I threw into our notes ahead of. Do either of you sort of key on a specific metric to sort of provide some indication that a moat might be present? Is there any one number that you sort of look to and go, this is an interesting competitive situation potentially?
I'm honored you asked me, but I have no idea, so I'm gonna punt this to Jim.
And I'm going to say no, disappointingly. I'm a cash flow guy, right? So I look at cash.
I think that's the answer. The two that came to mind when I was asking myself that question, as I was looking at some of these companies that we threw out into the air, I think an improving margin is one. An improving operating margin indicates pricing power potentially and ability to sort of get more out of your customers than what you're having to put into the cost-wise. I wonder about return on equity as well. Like a high return on equity might be an indication that there's a
maybe more return on capital especially in a world where we've seen a lot of companies kind of blow up their balance sheets with buybacks, and yet that's going to keep your equity account low and it's going to float your ROE higher. So more of a return on capital thing, I would argue for.
But it is. There's very much. I think maybe the message then is it's a mosaic approach. Yeah. There's no real like one like thing that any of us are going to point to and go boom moat. It's like you got to kind of understand the business and the dynamics behind the business.
I love the mosaic approach analogy. That's very 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 Charlie Munger of you. I think that's where I first heard that one. I think that's great.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.